The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
His name is Wallace Davidia. His wife was murdered by a small-time Palestinian second story man. He seeks retribution, not just from the murderer, but from an entire race. He'll let nothing stand in his way. And he and his elite force of international terrorists have just stolen the prototypes for a new kind of weapon that will tip the balance in his favor.
We're talking about a weapon that cannot jam and cannot misfire. Add to that a solid-state firing system with electronics that can be tied to a computer. This not only means you can trigger one or more of the weapons with a computer, but also that you can hook that computer up to a network and trigger the weapons using anything from remote access servers to networking protocols. More than that, you can fire them utilizing wireless technology. Last week, I got my first live-fire demo of 40mm shells from four separate pods on a low-altitude, high-speed pass. They put 57,000 grenades into an area no larger than a football field in under a minute.
With enough of these things, the terrorists can trigger weapons and unleash destruction like nothing ever previously witnessed with small arms. And they can do it from thousands of miles away.
Death to the enemies of my brothers!
The men and women of Stony Man are about to have a very rough day. Don't miss Stony Man number 78, Maelstrom, coming in January 2006.
Stony Man number 78, Maelstrom, will be in travel centers and truck stops throughout North America starting January 2006. Or call 1-800-670-5220 to reserve or download your advance copy. For your convenience, this information is also printed on the cover of this book.
What do we got, boss?
Shut up and follow me. You're a MAGA Palladiumville. You don't ask questions.
Sorry, boss. What was...
I heard it, too.
Wasn't far. Cover my sinks.
Boss, I saw it. I saw it. Oh!
What the hell?
Perfect.
Good day, Kane, Grant, Bridget, Domi. Thank you for gathering on such short notice.
Lakesh, where the hell are you?
Listen to me closely, all of you. You have no doubt heard about the recent assaults upon the baronies. I have discovered the meaning behind these attacks. There is something called Uluru, near Australia. It holds untold power inside, though nobody knows how to unlock its secrets. The hybrids even now assemble an invasion force in the Scific Islands, north of Australia, to capture Uluru. Should they come into possession of its secrets, the consequences would be disastrous. I am told that Erica Van Sloan herself is overseeing the operation. You can expect massive resistance, if not the Barons themselves.
How much time do we have?
I want you to leave in 20 minutes.
The secrets of Uluru will not escape me a second time.
So, what is it you want from me?
You have material assets, which might be of great assistance.
So I do. So I do.
As Kane and the Outlanders head off to the Scific, Erica and the Barons hatch a plan to capture a great lost power from the Earth itself. But there is a third faction, with its own mysterious agenda. One that will change the fate of the planet. Outlanders number 31, Uluru Destiny.
Outlanders number 31, Uluru Destiny, will be in travel centers and truck stops throughout North America starting January 2006. Or call 1-800-670-5220 to reserve or download your advance copy. For your convenience, this information is also printed on the cover of this book.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
And now, our feature presentation. A 100 years ago, a rain of nuclear bombs obliterated civilization in a few minutes of blazing horror. It was the end of the world. Doomsday, sky dark. With the first nuclear explosion, the tissue-thin tapestry of civilization was ripped apart. The rule of law was replaced overnight with the somber, draconian edict of survival of the fittest. Cannibals hunted prey, cold hearts brutally raided farms, and slavers seized anybody they could as chattel. Electricity was seldom seen, starvation universal, rape a daily event, death the only known means of escape. This is America in the late 21st century. Welcome to the Deathlands. Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Deathlands. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by Terrence Aselford, Colleen Delaney, Nanette Savard, Christopher Graybill, Kate Torrey, Michael Raflogel, and David Coyne. Deathlands number 4, Crater Lake. Jack Lauren's eyes, pale pink, snapped open. A fearsome stab of pain jerked through his narrow skull, making him close his eyes again. His fingers curled, nails digging into the palms of his hands. As he moved, leaning against the thick glass walls of the chamber, the tiny shards of razored steel sewn into his clothes sparkled brightly.
Was blind, but now I see.
Why did the words of the old hymn come floating back into his mind at that moment? He cautiously opened his eyes again, screwing them up against the bright light. There was a pattern of raised discs of polished metal that glowed faintly, the image fading even as he looked at it. The smoked glass walls were deep crimson. That wasn't right. They'd been blue. Blue. He held on to that fact. His head felt awful. Worse than the time, it had been his 10th birthing day just over 4 years back, when his father had been burrowing. Digging into the cellars of some of the derelict houses on the edge of West Lowellton, near Lafayette, in what had once been Louisiana, his father had found a bottle of something called Southern Comfort, a ribbed bottle of clear glass with a golden cap. He'd given it to Jack. The warm liquor had tasted of peaches in summer, and it had burned his throat. He'd drunk nearly the whole bottle, and then been monstrously sick. But that hadn't been anything compared to this awful swirling feeling. It was as if someone had sucked his brains from the cavern chambers of his skull, leaving only an echoing hollow, or pumped his brain like a pink-gray slurry through the twisted copper tubes of a moonshiner still, then spat the results back into his skull again.
How you doing, Whitey?
Jack leaned over. He felt like throwing up. His long hair, purest white, trailed like plumes of lace over his shoulders. He drew in deep breaths, fighting for control. He didn't want to show any sign of weakness in front of his 6 new friends.
Not friends.
Friends would betray you. Or they could be used to try to make you turn traitor. Companions was better.
What's that?
He didn't realize he'd spoken out loud.
Huh. Cold.
Lauren could see the fog of his breath. Back home in Louisiana, he'd never seen that. Never seen snow or felt the bite of frost. He hadn't really believed that this gateway place would actually work and transmit them somewhere else.
Yeah, just sit back and relax. It's a shit feeling, but it'll pass.
First time's always the worst, Jack.
Jack risked opening his eyes again, keeping his head perfectly still. The armored glass felt cool against his skin. The others were strewn around the room in varying stages of recovery from the Matrans jump. His eyes first focused on the girl called Lori. At 6 feet, she topped him by at least 9 inches. Her long blonde hair tumbled over her shoulders and across the bright red satin blouse that clung to the soft swell of her breasts. The boy's eyes were caught by the nipples, roused by the bitter cold in the gateway, peeking under the thin material. Her long thighs shone beneath the short maroon suede skirt. Jack knew that Lori was only a couple of years older than he was. He'd admired the grace with which she bore herself, despite wearing the most absurd boots he'd ever seen. They were made of crimson leather, well over her knees, and had incredibly high heels. He had watched with disbelief when she'd run like a gazelle in those boots. Now she moved uneasily, the tiny silver spurs on each heel ringing like bells. At her belt, she wore a pearl-handled .22 caliber Walther PPK pistol. Next to her, one arm protectively around the girl's shoulders, was the oldest of the party, Dr. Theophilus Tanner. He looked around 70, with grizzled hair and a graying stubble on his cadaverous jaw. He was tall and skinny, and wore cracked knee boots splattered with Louisiana swamp mud. The pale blue denim shirt and stained frock coat that he wore seemed like relics, something out of an old, old picture book from well before the big war. A kerchief with a blue swallow's eye design protruded from the top pocket of his coat, and a battered stovepipe hat was beside him on the floor.
I trust you are feeling a little more like rejoining the land of the living, my young friend.
Better?
Doc patted Lori companionably on the arm, dislodging his walking cane from his lap. It was made of polished ebony, with a carved lion's head in silver at its top. Jack knew, because Finnegan had told him, that the stick concealed a rapier-thin sword. The old man also carried a bizarre double-barreled cap-and-ball pistol called a Lama. Finnegan winked at Jack. The short, fat man looked pale from the jump, beads of sweat dappling his sallow forehead.
Way weird, huh, kid?
Huh.
Jack nodded. He envied the way Finn dressed, though it did make him look a bit like a sec man, matching sweater and pants in dark blue and high black combat boots with steel-capped toes. One of the things that Jack Loren knew a lot about was killing, and all the ways of doing it. His father had often told him that killing was a craft like any other. And like any other, it had to be learned. Jack had learned it well. In a soft leather sheath on his hip, Finnegan carried a long butcher's cleaver, its edge honed until it sang. In his belt was a 9mm Model 92 Beretta. Finn's chubby hands cradled a Heckler & Koch submachine gun. Able to fire 50 rounds on either single, triple, or continuous, it also sported a trim silencer. Jack had seen blaster catalogs in the undamaged houses where he'd been raised and recognized the weapon as a development from the HK-54A2 from the late 90s. Jack pushed against the wall, trying to stand up. The man next around the circle shook his head.
Give it time.
J.B. Dix, the armorer, never used 4 words when 3 would be enough. J.B. was the calmest, quietest man Jack Loren had ever met. Lightly built, he weighed not much more than Jack's own 120. Around 40 years old, with a thin face and a yellowish complexion, he wore rimless glasses and habitually sported a battered fedora. Jack noticed he had the trick of never watching you when you expected it, and always watching you when you weren't ready. In a handmade canvas sling at his waist, he carried a mini-Uzi, complemented by a Steyr-Aug 5.6mm handgun on his hip. Jack suspected, though he hadn't seen any evidence of it, that J.B. also had a variety of hidden knives and other weapons about his person, perhaps under his leather jacket and nondescript pants.
My first jump, I thought I was going to die.
Know what you mean, Christy.
Christy Roth scared the shit out of Jack. She was also tall, close to 6 feet, with a great body that fueled his adolescent fantasies. She had piercing green eyes and the brightest, thickest red hair the boy had ever encountered.